So now comes the big million-dollar question. How do you actually elicit a state in such a way that it sets the hypnotic context that you can actually anchor it? In other words, how can you go after, can you hunt a state, a feeling, in such a way that the very fact that you're finding it allows you to anchor it with ease? Given that you are both hypnotists, can you think of a process that will allow you to bring to life, and I say that very specifically, a state, which by its very nature of how you're doing it, will create a hypnotic context?
So a revivification.
Exactly. A revivification is basically a way of asking questions about an experience someone's had, which brings that experience back to life. If you think about your neurology, your nervous system being like lights on a Christmas tree, it's like slowly kind of injecting little bits of electricity into one particular pattern. So you kind of say, all right, I want the bit around the heart to glow up. So I'm going to touch it a little bit and it starts glowing faintly. And I'm going to touch it again. It faints a bit more strongly. You put a little bit more juice in, it starts glowing more brightly. And every time you keep doing it, it glows more and more brightly until it has a shining beacon right there and then. And the process you use to do this is hypnotic. Essentially, what you're going to do is you're going to ask someone about an experience. An experience which is likely to have them enter a particular state. Now, the simplest way of doing this is to ask about an experience directly. For example, have you ever felt confident before? Have you ever felt strong before? Have you ever felt smart before? What's it like when you are feeling smart? What's it like when you do have that moment of inspiration or enthusiasm? So these are different states I might be going after. I'm just asking a very direct question about their personal history. Now, I'm looking for a specific event. I don't want it a general event because that's not going to be creating any strong emotion to it. I want a specific event. I may get to it via a general event because they might not think of a specific event straight away. They might have to think about the general event first, and then you drill down to something specific, and you get even more specific and more specific and more specific. And at each layer, it's like taking the layers of an onion. Each layer that you go down, the state intensifies more and more fully. So that's the idea behind it. How do you do this? Well, you basically ask questions. You use the echo effect to reflect back their answers because that becomes part of a feedback loop. And you ask other questions, deepening questions, that will peel the next layer of the onion. Whilst you're doing all this, you're going to be using your backups of your hypnotic language, which you've already learned in session two, and a very important hypnotic principle called going first. Now, I'm going to talk about that in a moment. First, let's do a quick demonstration of a revivification. Who would like to volunteer for this?
Yeah, I will then ego.
Okay, twist my arm, why don't you? So, Sean, is there a particular feeling that you'd like to enjoy now, or it was just feeling good, or enthusiastic, or happy, or just relaxed, confident? Any of those particularly grab your attention at the moment?
Yeah, just general happiness, really, just
General happiness. Okay, excellent.
yeah.
Tell me, have you ever felt happy before?
I have, yeah.
Have you really? Okay, so you have felt happy. When
Yeah.
have you felt happy, as an example?
The time I'm thinking of at the moment is when me and my girlfriend got engaged.
Well, that's a pretty happy time. So you and your girlfriend got engaged, right? So where were you when you and your girlfriend were getting engaged?
I were walking along outside of a river.
So you're walking along this river. What's the river called?
I don't know.
Doesn't matter. So
No,
you're
don't know.
walking along a river,
Yeah.
and what happens next? So you're there. Is it daytime or nighttime?
It's nighttime.
So it's nighttime. You're walking along the river, kind of a romantic walk. And then what happens?
So we were walking down, and we could see the restaurant up ahead of us that we were going to go in.
So you can see the
And
restaurant ahead of you.
yeah,
Yeah.
and yeah, then I just asked her if yeah, if she wanted to marry me, and luckily she said yeah, so.
So you're walking along the river bank, and you can see the restaurant up ahead of you. And you turn around, you ask her if she wants to marry you. And luckily, she says, yeah. How does it feel to have someone say yes to you like that?
It feels pretty good, actually, yeah.
It feels pretty good, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And how do you know that it feels pretty good?
Because
That's right.
I can feel it.
Very
It's
good. You
feeling
can
pretty good.
feel it, can't you?
Yeah.
And it is pretty good, isn't it?
Yep.
Very good. Now let's just pause there for a moment. For everyone that's listening, you should have heard a significant change in Sean's tonality. That significant change, using your, as NLP calls it, calibration skills, tells you that he's shifted state. And given the context that we were talking about and all the questions I was asking, I can be pretty sure, given the tonality and the context and the content and everything else, that that's a happy feeling. Would I be correct in my assumption?
You would, yeah.
Very good. So what we'll be doing there, let's investigate the kind of questions I was asking. First of all, I was asking an orienting question. I start off with a big frame, big chunk, so you have felt happy in the past. That's kind of a little truism. It's a yes set. There are very few people in this world who will ever say answer no to that question. There are some, and they tend to have more clinical issues, but there's very few. And so by making them acknowledge that they've had happy experiences in the past, you're already beginning to send their mind on a little search looking for a happy experience. So it gives their mind a little bit of time, a little bit of warning of where you're going with this. So you've had a happy experience in the past. I go, sure. So can you give me an example of one? Now that is known, back to your Milton model, as a conversational postulate. It's a language pattern, it's a hypnotic pattern. Can you give me an example? The answer is yes or the answer is no. But what he's actually doing, rather than giving me a yes or no answer, is he's actually creating the experience. And in fact, just to be able to give me a yes or no answer, he has to actually go off and actually have that experience again in at least a small amount, just to know whether or not it existed. So by asking, can you give an example? Sometimes people will still go, oh, I don't know, maybe, and he goes, well, you felt happy before, and go, sure. Are you sure you felt happy? Yeah. Well, when did you feel happy? Well, I don't know. When was the last time? Well, I said, I don't know. And by keeping on at that question, eventually it'll spark a memory. It'll be like a flash of something, just as happened with Sean just then. And typically it doesn't take very long, by the way. The example I just gave you would be a very awkward example. Typically people will need one or two goes. You're like, can you be happy? Sure. Can you remember some time? Goes, well, not really. Well, sure, but you've been happy in the past. Of course I know. And there's been specific people or specific places, things you may have done that made you happy. Maybe you were at a party, or maybe someone said something nice to you. Now, notice that I'm giving examples at this point, examples for his unconscious mind to attach onto, and basically use that as a trigger to spark off a memory of something specific. And I want something specific because it's much easier to get the state at that point. So we had a specific memory, which was when Sean proposed to his girlfriend and she said yes. Now, we didn't know much about that memory just yet. And if you go back to the recording and listen to it again, you'll notice that while Sean was a little bit more animated, he wasn't that much more animated yet. So he's beginning to activate a sense of happiness, but it's not fully there yet. It's not fully activated yet. So where did we do at that point? Well, the first thing is we're starting to reflect back the language that he's giving to me. Now, I'm not using active listening. Active listening does not work for this kind of context. Why? Because what I'm doing is I'm creating a feedback loop. I'm using the exact same words and phrases to feed back into him because those words and phrases are basically the keys that turn on the ignition for him. That's why he's using them. His unconscious mind created them spontaneously because those words and phrases are attached in some way or form to that memory. If I use different words and phrases, I might still get somewhere similar, but I'm taking a risk. I'm taking a risk that it means something different to him. And even if that risk does pay off, I'm more likely to get a stronger response using the echo effect, in other words, reflecting the exact same words or phrases right back again, because they're more directly connected. So I ask an initial orienting question. I ask a more specific orienting question, i.e., give me a specific memory. And then I start reflecting back what he's giving me. I reflect back a few phrases. Then I ask my next question, now a deepening question. How do you ask the question? Well, basically, I want sensory information. In order for him to give me sensory information, things like where is he, what can he see, what can he feel, what can he hear, taste and smell as well. In order to answer those questions, he's got to put himself back in the situation and have the experience, which of course is going to activate the experience, which means that I now get to evoke the experience fully in him. Notice again how I did a couple of things. I changed my language from referring to the past, so you were by the river, weren't you, to the present tense. So you are walking by the river. You can see that restaurant over there. And you turn around and you ask your girlfriend to marry you. And luckily, she says, yeah. I didn't say yes because she didn't say yes. In his mind, she was going, yeah. That's what the words he was using, at least. So notice again, we're following the whole format through, and we're using ever more precise deepening questions like, where were you? When was it? What could you see? What can you sense? What can you smell? And once I have enough of those things going on, I can sense it kind of really activating, then I'm going to focus in on the feeling for the most part. I don't have to do this. Sometimes I'll just get the rush of the emotion and I don't even have to go into the feeling thing to cement in. That's fine. But to be complete, you have some very powerful questions like, how are you feeling when that's happening? How do you know you're feeling that way, or how do you know that's happening? What's it like when that happens? And listen out to what they give you. 9 times out of 10, they will give you what's called a personal trance word or trance phrase. A personal trance word or personal trance phrase for Sean, something that has come up many times in different contexts as well, is the words pretty good. I now know that if I use the words pretty good on things, that's going to motivate Sean immensely. In other words, it's going to stimulate that happy feeling. Now, I could use the word happy, but that's a bit too abstract for him. Using the words pretty good, though, has a lot of meaning for him. So, let's say I want to go to a movie with him and I say, hey, you're not going to watch this film. It's a pretty good film, you know. That's going to be a good way to begin to attach the associations he has pretty good, the happy feeling, to coming to the cinema as an example. At the moment, I'm using it in order to echo it again. So I'm using the echo effect again in order to reflect back his personal trance words or personal trance phrases, which then ups the ante again. And notice I do several cycles of this. Right, I'm kind of repeating it as though I'm checking I've got my information right, I've got my facts straight, but in doing so, I'm actually getting the information and I'm actually getting a stronger response out of him. So, if I want, Sean to re-experience that wonderful feeling again, that happy feeling, I might say something like, so, Sean, let me just check I've got this right. The day you proposed to your girlfriend, you were walking down by a river, you're heading over to a restaurant, you can see the restaurant off in the distance, and you asked her to marry you, and luckily she said yeah. And I made you feel pretty good, right? So next now just thank you very much.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
No, that's good. How does it feel to have all that thrown back at you, Sean?
Yeah, it feels good. It just pops the experience back up again.
It does, doesn't it? Now let's
Yeah.
compare that to doing it the wrong way, just for comparison's sake. So you're walking through town to, wherever you're going to, and you decided that now's the time, so you asked and she said yes. How's that make you feel?
It doesn't really, it doesn't change my mood at all.
Doesn't affect you. But I've given you the same information, and yet it doesn't affect you in the same way. It probably will affect you to some extent because you're still orienting back to the memory, but it does not affect you as fully as using the echo effect. Some people call it the track back frame because you're tracking back across what they've just said and you're feeding it back in again. That's just a bit of NLP jargon if you're interested in it. So, in order to do a revivification, in other words, to bring an experience back to life, you're going to ask an orienting question about the experience. You're going to reflect back, you're going to echo back their language, you're going to ask a deepening question, and you keep cycling between the echo effect and the deepening questions until you have a strong enough state and you have them really buzzing. Deepening questions are about their senses. What can you see, hear, feel, touch, taste? About time. When are you? Who else is around with you? What colors? You know, what else is around there? And specifically about emotions. How do you feel? How do you know you're feeling that way? What's it like when you are feeling that way? Right? Those final questions in particular have a way of really amping up the intensity, the juice of the question, because you're focusing in on the emotional experience. There are times when you don't want to do that. And that is, you'll know that, you know exactly when that time is, because when you ask that question, it will make the feeling evaporate for some people because they put too much conscious attention on it. And it becomes a law of reverse effect. Basically, the harder they try to have the feeling, the further removed they become from the feeling. It does happen from time to time. Do look out for it. But most of the time, asking about a feeling will intensify it. If it doesn't, you'll know why. You'll know to stay clear of it. You'll just ask orienting questions, and you'll make sure that the feeling just gets created indirectly in that way. Does that make sense to everyone?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. So, how can you back this up? Now, you'll notice that I've really started playing with language a little bit. Remember we talked about presuppositions? I changed my presuppositions of time by changing my tense from the past tense, so you were walking along the river, to the present tense, so you are walking by the river. Why? Because present tense events are more powerful, you feel them more strongly than things in the past. Right? That's why people say time is a great healer, because the emotions become less distinct as they are passed, as a rule. The other thing you want to do is to go first. This is a very old rule in hypnosis, and something that you really want to use in your NLP school as well. Basically, have you ever noticed how humor is infectious? When someone starts laughing, everyone else starts wanting to laugh as well. When someone starts sneezing, or rather yawning, other people start yawning as well. When someone gets really excited about something, it's a lot easier to get excited. When you walk into a room where everyone is sad and depressed, you suddenly feel like you're walking on eggshells, and you have to be more careful, and you start feeling a bit quieter yourself. So when you have a particular emotional state inside of you, when you feel a particular emotional state, you end up sub-communicating that. Remember, in your universal modeling process, the state, in other words, the way you're feeling right now, doesn't just affect your behavior, but it also affects your physiology, the way you carry yourself, the way you're breathing, the expression you have in your face. All these things, on a tiny level and on a bigger level, will be affected by your state. So if you walk into a room or you're with someone who's feeling good, they will sub-communicate through these subtle little cues in their body language how they're feeling, and we will pick up on them and we will be influenced by them. So, whenever you are going after a state, you should go first. Try and activate that inside yourself first. Have the experience first. And that way, you set the context which will make it easier for them to have the experience. Now, let me give you an example of what happens when you do it wrong. Sean, can I borrow you again as an example for this?
Yep.
Okay. Sean, I'd like you to get excited. Really, really excited. I mean, I'm sure you had times when you got really excited, you know, about stuff, right?
Yeah.
Okay, now notice what just happened there. Notice the tone of voice with which Sean responded. He was following the state which was communicated just in my tonality at that point, my tonality, my rhythm, the speed of language. And that's what infected him to a certain extent. It gives him an idea of where to begin looking for it. And unfortunately, the answer to my question, the logical question, isn't in the place he's going looking for it, which is, you know, somewhere around here. So if I want Sean to get excited, I'm going to say something like, hey, Sean, you know, there are times, and you know, there are times you got a little bit excited about stuff, right?
Yep.
Okay. Notice again, just in the way I've asked the question, it's changed his initial response. In other words, he's opened the door to a very different room, and he's going to start looking there first for, you know, exciting memories, etc. Now, does that mean you can't do it the other way? Sure, anything is possible. But you'll have to work at it so much harder doing it the other way than if you do actually go first yourself. So go first. Use your language as a great way of backing it up. Remember the cycle of questions, echo effect, deepening questions, echo effect, deepening questions, and cycling through that. And keep watching them. Keep listening to them until they are there in the state that you want them to be in. Now, because what you're doing is hypnotic in nature, by the time they have the state, they'll be ready to be anchored. So anchoring will actually be very simple. Actually, in this context, I did a couple of tonal anchors. So just by saying pretty good, it will tend to give them a little jolt, a little buzz of that excitement. And that is the beauty of anchoring. Once you've found the state, once you've intensified the state using your language, you've pretty much already anchored it. Now, whether you anchor it, something else as well, like with a touch or a magic word or something like that's all good too. But you have it. It's already there. Now, before we look at the actual steps for setting the anchor, now that you've created the state and they're pretty much ripe for the plucking, you just do the setting and you're done. I'd like to throw a challenge at you guys. Remember that states can be discovered in two ways. There are spontaneous states and there's states that you go after, that you elicit. Now, if you have a spontaneous state, you have a problem. Remember what the problem is?
Only that, did you say it wouldn't be intense enough, so you'd have to do it repeated times?
It's spontaneous, it might be intense enough, but you're getting close. The biggest problem you might run into, I'm not saying you will, but you might run into, is because you haven't set up a hypnotic context, ABS in other words, they may not be in a context where traditional anchoring or NLP style anchoring works, right? Because you haven't really created a hypnotic context yet. Do you see how that works?
Right, yeah.
If you're eliciting a state, on the other hand, you're creating the context just by doing it. But if it happens spontaneously, say in a conversation, you may not yet have the context to do that. So how can you remedy that? Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, if they're having a strong emotional response, you will have a couple of the prerequisites. You'll at least have the bypassing of the critical factor, and you'll probably have the stimulation of the unconscious mind. The thing you haven't got yet is the connection to them, which is usually where the attention comes from. So in other words, the unconscious mind has to recognize you as a source of valid input for suggestions. How do you do this? Well, there's something called hypnotic rapport. Have you ever noticed that when you're in deep rapport with someone, they end up completing your thoughts, or they know exactly what you're talking about without you saying something. You say, when I like, and I go, yeah, I know. Now people outside are going to go, what the hell are these guys talking about? They're talking in half sentences, and I have no idea what they're referring to. But you guys do, because you're in deep rapport, and through subtle language and body postures, etc., you're very attuned to each other to respond to these subtle cues, so you know exactly what you're talking about to each other. But then you have other people who you're deeply out of rapport with, and you have this sense of like real malaise, like the message really isn't sinking in. You're saying something, they hear the words going, yep. And you have this really bad sinking feeling inside, which goes, they're not getting this. I'm not getting through this person properly. And typically, when that happens, later on you find out that that's actually the case. They misunderstood. They aren't actually doing what you asked them to do, etc. Right? Have you kind of sensed these sort of situations before?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, not all the time, but of course it does happen from time to time. So, if you want to do a very elegant job of anchoring, you want to create hypnotic rapport, which basically creates that private bubble between you and them, so that everything that you communicate, whether overtly or covertly, in other words, subcommunicated in your body language, your tonality, etc., or overtly in the ideas you present to someone, will have a stronger impact, a larger impact. And at that point, you again create a hypnotic context, and again, you have the perfect conditions to set anchors. How do you do that? Well, let's go right back to our rapport section. We've talked about matching and mirroring. We've talked about micro matching and micro mirroring. When you do these things elegantly, you create this private bubble between you two. Then the unconscious mind is finely attuned to being responsive to you, at which point creating an anchor becomes again very straightforward. And remember, if you can't do the whole matching and mirroring thing naturally, which most people can't do naturally, at least not at the beginning, it's still worth practicing it kind of crudely, at least with friends, just to get used to the mechanism. But ultimately, the easiest way of doing it is to use the instant rapport technique. And the simplified version of that, of course, is remember someone you're close to, someone you do have that kind of rapport with. Feel the emotion inside your body, intensify it, let it grow, and then project it through you into the other person so that it creates like an emotional bond that you feel. At that point, you can forget about what you're doing and get on with your conversation because your unconscious mind at that point will probably, I mean, it's very likely there are rare occasions when this doesn't happen, but it's a real specialty problem. But 99 times out of 100, it will end up automatically creating deep rapport with the other person, and you've already created the context again. Now, here's why NLP can be so slippery. Pretty much everything I've talked to you about so far is something that you don't see unless you're taught to look for it. And I know from my own experience and my own NLP training, I wasn't taught it. I had to observe it from other people. I had to find out from trial and error and through all kinds of other things. And this is really where the gold dust of NLP is at. It's in the things that other people don't see until they're given a little lens through which to look at the world, and suddenly they see only that. And that starts making a lot more sense. So what I want you to look at is the hypnotic context. And specifically, are people paying attention to you? And the more they pay attention to you than to anything else, the better. Are you bypassing the critical factor? In other words, are they arguing less and less? Are they finding less and less exceptions? Are they being less cynical, less analytical, etc.? And are you stimulating their unconscious mind? In other words, are their responses becoming faster, more genuine, more natural, more spontaneous, etc.? And of course, more emotional, more and stronger. At that point, you have everything in place. You can either use the revivification questions in order to create that context, or you can use things like the instant rapport technique to create that context, or you might find yourself in that context spontaneously, at which point you know that you can anchor pretty much anything that happens automatically. In fact, you could not anchor things at that point. Okay? So that deals with both spontaneous and elicited states. Now, what are the conditions for actually anchoring? These are the conditions that you'll get taught in any NLP program. Everything I've said so far is the background, which you hopefully will pick up in the sidelines when you do an NLP program, but won't necessarily be taught officially. A lot of people don't even know it, I don't think. But the following conditions are what you will be taught, and this is something very important because it gives you the sequence for actually creating an anchor. The very first thing you need is a pure state. That's the first condition. What I mean by a pure state? Well, first of all, you don't want to have mixed emotions. If you want someone being confident, you don't want them feeling confident with a little bit of hesitancy or a little bit of fear or a little bit of annoyance or a little bit of anger mixed in. Why? Because you're going to be anchoring the whole ballpark. And if you have mixed emotions, well, it's going to be very difficult to use the emotion that you need. You're going to basically weaken the cocktail unless you're creating a cocktail of states which support each other, which is absolutely possible. So the first thing, you want to have a pure state. The other thing, by the way, that is encapsulated in a pure state, which people don't talk about but is kind of assumed, and when you do assume it, it works out great, and if you don't assume it again, you end up having big difficulties, is that when you have a pure state, you basically bypassed the critical factor. They're not thinking, they're just feeling, which basically means there's no critical factor, so B is being taken care of, and this is in a pure unconscious response, so S has been taken care of. So again, the pure state is setting the conditions for a hypnotic context. Secondly, you need to time it right. If you look in your manual under the anchoring section, you'll see a little diagram in there, and you'll see basically a little bell curve. In other words, like a little mountain, a line that goes up and comes back down. So remember we talked about at the beginning, a state is something that has a beginning, middle, and an end. It peaks and it troughs like a wave. It doesn't last very long, per se. In other words, it lasts from anywhere from a couple of seconds to a minute or two, at which point, if it isn't replenished or augmented, it will recede again. So when you have elicited the state in someone, you basically want to anchor it before it peaks. You want to anchor it before it peaks so that when it has peaked, your anchor has already been released, so that your anchor triggers the most intense part of the experience, not the experience as it's running down. So your timing basically is you'll watch them, they're getting, let's say you're using enthusiasm, they get more enthused, more enthused, more enthused, they're ready to pop, you might touch them on the shoulder, in other words, you do the anchor, and then you release the anchor just before or just after they peak and start coming down again. If you want to condition it, you want to do a couple of cycles, you'll do the same thing again, and just as they're peaking, same motion, same touch, same whatever. And just as it starts receding again, you remove the anchor. So that way, you're anchoring the most intense part of the experience, and you're anchoring it on the way up rather than the way down. Do those two ideas make sense so far?
Yes. Can you also use sliding anchors?
Absolutely. We'll
Thank
talk
you.
about those in a moment. We'll talk about those in a moment. At the moment, we're just setting the condition for anchoring. So whether you're using a sliding anchor, a regular anchor, your physical anchor, like a kinesthetic anchor, like a touch, a visual anchor, like a gesture, an auditory anchor, like a word or a bit of tonality or a smell, it doesn't really matter what it is. We're looking at the conditions that will apply to all of them. So the first condition is a pure state. The second condition is correct timing. The third condition is a unique anchor or unique stimulus. Basically, we end up being bombarded by stimuli all the time. You want to have a stimulus that's unique so that it's easier. It doesn't come preloaded with other conditioning, with other anchors, so that it's easy for the unconscious mind to realize what you're expecting from it. So, for example, people don't tend to get touched on their shoulders that much, at least not in Western culture. So that a hand on the shoulder could be a great anchor just because it's unique. A hand on a kneecap can be even more unique. But again, you've got to watch the context because sometimes it can also be a loaded message. When a man puts his hand on a woman's knee and vice versa, it could have a sexual connotation if done at an inappropriate time or in an inappropriate way. Done appropriately, it can work tremendously well. But again, you need to ask, especially if it's possible that you have something else, another meaning attached to it. You're going to have to ask for permission ahead of time. And more importantly, you may want to just choose a different anchor altogether that can't be misunderstood in that way. Unless, of course, you're doing it with a spouse or a loved one, in which case you may want to have those connotations also included and bundled up in your anchor. But you want to have a unique stimulus so that it's not overloaded with other things. So you can always use that stimulus, that anchor, to trigger that specific response. It makes it much cleaner that you'll get exactly what you want and what you expect, and not something unexpected as well. An example for non-unique stimulus, in other words, a poor anchor, might be things like shaking someone's hand. If you shake people's hands a lot, it can lose its meaning, or at least its meaning in terms of what you're doing, because it can get eroded with all kinds of other stimuli being, or rather, all kinds of other responses being associated also, and it kind of masks the effect of what you want as well. Finally, we have something related to the unique stimulus, which means you've got to be able to duplicate the stimulus. If your anchor is so unique that the exact conditions can only ever be recreated every 100 years or so, when Venus is in the ascendant and the moon is at a certain angle to the Earth and there's a fire here and the temperature is a certain level and all the rest of it, well, you may well have a fantastic anchor, but you'll never be able to use it. So you need to be able to duplicate the anchor with reasonable confidence that you'll get it right. Otherwise, you just won't get a response and you've wasted your time. So those are the four conditions of anchoring: a pure state, a correct timing, a unique stimulus or a unique anchor, and something that's easy to duplicate. When you have those four things, you can create anchors quickly, easily, and efficiently. Does all this make sense so far?
Yep.
So, what is the actual process that you do? Okay, very simply. Elicit a state. We've already shown you how. When the state starts to peak, you choose ahead of time an anchor. Let's say we're going to go with a very simple kinesthetic anchor, and that's going to be a touch on the shoulder from a certain angle in a certain position. So I say something like, so you're walking down the river, by the river, you see the restaurant, and You ask her, and luckily she says yes, and you feel pretty good. Or how do you feel? Pretty good. Hand on shoulder. You do feel pretty good, right? Now notice, I'm doing two things at the same time. The bit you can't see is the bit where I'm touching someone on the shoulder, or at least I'm pretending to. The bit you can hear is where I'm emphasizing the words feel pretty good. Now I've created both a tonal anchor and a hypnotic phrase. Why? Because when I say the words feel pretty good in that rhythm, it's going to trigger the same anchor again in the other person. At the same time, I could, that's an example of a phrase being used as an anchor. It could also just be the tone. So I could say, have you ever thought about going to the cinema? So I'm using the similar tonality, the same rhythm, in order to activate the same kind of conditions. Now that may take a little bit more effort to get the unconscious mind to recognize the rhythm rather than just the words. But if you do your conditioning cycles right, they will get that also. This is what happens when, for those of you who have got my conversational hypnosis home study program, when you condition someone to your hypnotic voice. It's not that you have a magical voice that everyone responds to as though it were hypnotic. It's that you can create a certain tonality that when you speak in it, you condition people, you're anchoring people to go into hypnosis just by the sound of that special voice. So that's one of the reasons behind that working, and one of the ways that you can also use yourself effectively. The simplest way for you to do it, though, is to start off with a touch. Why? Because touching is a very simple thing to do, and because you're doing it outside of a sensory system that they might be paying attention to. If you're talking to someone, they might pay attention to your voice, or they may pay attention to your gestures, but they're not paying attention to their feelings. You can distract their mental capacity, their mindset. In other words, you will distract their critical factor by the things that you're saying, whilst the physical touch creates the anchor for the state that they're currently experiencing. Do you see how that can kind of work as a nice little misdirection tactic?
Yep.
Okay, so the steps again, you elicit the state. When it starts to peak, you'll reach over and you say you'll touch them on the shoulder, or you touch the knee, or you touch the hand in a particular way. In other words, a way that you can repeat again. You hold on to it for a little while, and before the state peaks and begins to recede again, you let go and you distract them. In other words, you want to break the state. You want to distract them, you want to break that mood, you want to break that feeling, so that the feeling is clearly associated to that touch and to nothing else. So then you talk about something else, maybe, I don't know, some other person, or you maybe tell a story, or I don't know, it doesn't matter what it is. If you're doing NLP very directly, you'll literally just say, clear your mind, make it a blank, right? That's the easiest way of breaking someone's state. And then you want to go through a couple of conditioning cycles. You do want conditioning cycles because although you could do it in one trial, typically, especially the more covert you're doing this, the more covertly you're doing it, the more you will need one or two trials so the unconscious mind kind of picks up the pattern. So then you do the same thing again. You revivify the experience again. You wait for the peak. You reach over. You touch them again the same way, or you say the same phrase. You use the same tonality. And then again, you let go and you break the state. You may do that 2 times, 3 times, 4 times, 5 times. You'll know that you're done when you're testing. How do you test? Well, you break their state so that they are thinking about something else, and casually you reach over and you touch them on the shoulder in that particular way. Or if you use your tonality, you speak in that particular way. Or if you use a certain phrase, you say that phrase in that particular tonality, in that particular rhythm. And then you watch what happens. Does the physiology change? Do they light up with enthusiasm, if enthusiasm was a state you're going for? Or do you see them relaxing, if relaxation was a state you were after? Whatever it is, you notice what's going on. If the test works, you're done. If they kind of go into it, but they're not quite there yet, you may want to shore it up by encouraging them to have the feeling again. So now you're going back into conditioning cycles. You do 2 or 3 more, and then you test again and see what happens. Eventually, just that touch will create the response in exactly the same way as Pavlov ringing his bell would actually create the salivation in the dogs. Does all this make sense? Do you understand what an anchor is? How it evolves? Where it came from? How to create one? The problems you could run up against? And the solutions to those problems?
Yep.
Okay. Any questions so far?
How important is it to anchor in their primary representational system?
Not important at all. In fact, it may even be useful to choose a representational system that they are not used to. So, for example, if someone's very visual, you may want to do it in a kinesthetic system, in other words, a touching anchor, because they won't consciously be aware of it, so they won't interfere with it. Remember, the representational systems tells you where their consciousness needs to go in order to access information, right? And to create a hypnotic context, you don't want their conscious attention, you want their unconscious attention. And to get that, you still want their conscious attention on something, and particularly on you. But whilst, and this is a very elegant way of doing it, by the way, whilst you're distracting them with, say, something visual, or, you know, maybe describing an image or something like that, you can reach over and touch them whilst having the experience and then release it. And very often, people don't even realize you've touched them at that point. But the anchor will still work because the unconscious mind, of course, is aware of the physical sensation, even if it doesn't allow them to be consciously aware of it at one point in time. Does that make sense to you, Nathan?
Yes.
Good question. Now, before we leave the topic of anchoring, I want to discuss some of the basic types of anchors you can find. Although we won't go into full-blown anchoring techniques, which we'll cover in the next session, there are different styles of anchors, if you like, that you can set. The one we've discussed so far really is a simple anchor. It's very direct. It's a touch, it's a word, it's a sound, it's a gesture. It could even be a smell or a taste. It's a very simple, direct anchor. You can also have something called stacking anchors. When you stack anchors, basically, you want to have a very powerful anchor. You can stack different emotions or different examples of the same emotions on the same anchor, thereby making it more powerful. How do you do this? Well, you set the anchor, let's say, for calmness. You elicit it in the way we described. You anchor it in the way we described. You test it how we described, and you're good. Now, let's say that you want to have even more calmness, a different kind of calmness from a different event in their life. Now you go back and you ask them about a different event. You elicit that one, how we've shown you. You intensify that, as we've shown you. And then you anchor that one in the same place. Now, the same anchor is going to have two different experiences of calmness combining to become a kind of a greater sense of calmness than they've experienced yet. Another way to use stacking anchors is to create a cocktail or a blend of states. So rather having calmness stacked on top of calmness, you might have calmness and curiosity and a little bit of intrigue and some thoughtfulness. So those are four different states. You find four different times in their lives that they've had each one of those. And at the peak of that, you anchor each one of them exactly the same place. Now when you fire the anchor, you'll have a cocktail of experiences. They'll feel calm but curious, a little bit intrigued about what's going on, and thoughtful, in other words, thinking about the situation at hand. So that's how you create a blend of context. That's called stacking anchors. The next one is called sliding anchors. Sliding anchors is really a way of intensifying it, an anchor, through a non-verbal mean. Let's take, for example, the example that you create an anchor of, say, touching their kneecap with a particular finger. Now, with a combination of hypnotic language and movement, you can actually intensify the feelings by something like, you know, take this feeling and make it stronger and stronger and stronger still. Now, notice how I'm using a tonal variation of sliding anchors there. I'm using the word stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger still. So my tonality is giving you a suggestion that it should intensify the experience, as well as, of course, using the words. I can do it by literally sliding my finger up the leg. It could be sliding the finger up the arm. It could be something you do in space. For example, if your anchor is a gesture in sort of like your belly level, you might start lifting your hand up in exactly the same gesture in a straight line upwards as you say stronger and stronger and stronger. And as your hand rises up, it becomes a metaphor, a visual metaphor to the unconscious mind for lifting up, intensifying the state. And the opposite is true as well. You might bring the hand back down, which will be a visual metaphor for diminishing the intensity of this state. So now you have a sliding control over the intensity. Do those three types of anchors make sense? Simple anchors, stacking anchors, and sliding anchors.
Yep.
Yep.
Any questions on those? I'll take that as a no. The final type of anchor that I want to discuss today, before we turn into actual anchoring techniques and how to use anchoring in the NLP techniques sort of way for coaching, therapy, etc., for basically running your own brain. The final type of anchoring that I want to talk to you about today is basically known as condiment anchoring, although it's not necessarily the best description. Condiment anchoring is basically when you use naturally occurring objects in your environment in order to anchor people totally covertly as a part of a natural conversation. To do this, remember you still need a hypnotic context. So you still need their attention. You'll still need to have bypassed the critical factor. You still need to be stimulating their unconscious mind. You can do all this with conversational patterns by using, for example, the Milton model we talked about in session 2 to absorb their attention and guide their imagination to different ideas. Now, once you have them at that point, whenever you see them going to a positive state or whenever you're talking about positive ideas, you can use condiment anchoring. You can use a gesture or a something that's in your environment to be a very natural anchor. So the example might be you're in a coffee shop, and every time you talk about something positive, you shake a little packet of sugar. Every time you talk about something negative, you may kind of touch your a glass of water. Now, if you do this, if you go backwards and forwards between the negative and the positive, and you shake the little sugar packet each time and you touch a glass of water each time, eventually you will create the pattern at the unconscious level. How quickly that happens depends on how much hypnotic rapport you've built. In other words, how strong the hypnotic context that you've set up. Let's assume it takes 4 or 5 rounds of this. At this point, they get conditioned. They have an anchor that the packet of sugar is for good things, the glass of water is for bad things. So you may want to, let's say you're going to use it in a sales meeting. You can talk about your product and hold the little sugar packet and maybe flick the little sugar packet as you talk about your product, which becomes an unconscious suggestion. Feel good as you're thinking about this. Think positive thoughts as you think about my product. The same is true as you talk about a competitor's product or as they start talking about a competitor's product. You may start pushing the glass of water around as they talk about that, which is a suggestion that, this is not a positive thing. This is not something that you want to be spending much time on. You can even be more overt about it so that you say, you've got a choice between your competitor's product, pointing towards the water, or my product, pointing towards the sugar packet, but doing it in this kind of casual manner so that they don't know that you're creating the two conditions. What you use is really down to your creativity. You could, for example, adjust your tie every time something positive happens and have a little frown and a shake of your head every time something negative is happening. I know one lawyer, and this is a little bit unscrupulous, I have to admit, who will anchor everything positive, good, and nice to the chair that his client is sitting in, which basically indirectly anchors it to his client. And will anchor everything negative, distrustworthy, and despicable to the chair that the opposing legal teams, the bench that they're sitting in, so that every time the jury looks at the opposing team in their arguments, they will tend to think of them in a more negative light. Whenever they look at their client or listen to the lawyer speaking about the client's case, they will view those points and comments in a very positive sense or a very positive light. So that's some of the ways that people use it. You can use it as a therapeutic tool, as a coaching tool, as a way of people making people around you feel happier and more alive and alert. It's a wonderful set of tools, and I would encourage you to use it as such, because the more people around you feel good, the more you'll have good feelings being reflected right back at you, so you live in a happier, better world, and I think that's a good thing all around. So do you guys kind of get the idea of anchoring? And how to do it, when to do it, where to do it, and what it is.
Yep.